He's not a decorated soldier, though he says he is. But he conquered my heart when first we kissed. It felt just like peanut butter meeting jam. Don't matter that he never fought the Taliban. Stolen valor stole my heart. He'd be Picasso if kissing were. My special man. I know he ordered all his medals online, but when he takes off his uniform, he looks so fine. When he spits in my mouth, it tastes like fine wine. And when he's in my foxhole, I feel just like I'm dying. Stolen valor stole my heart. He'd be Picasso if kissing were an art. And if you call him out, war's gonna start. 'Cause he's my special man. Stolen valor stole my heart. He'd be Picasso if kissing were an art. And if you call him out, war's gonna start. 'Cause he's my special man.
That was Lee Carlson doing a cover of Tamara Funt's controversial yet amazing song, Stolen Valor. And I am Duncan Trussell, and you are listening to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast. If you don't know me, I'm a Nepo baby. My father owns Raytheon, and I'm currently living on one of his vineyards. I'm here because last summer I had a psychotic episode because of some tainted toad venom that I got from an unscrupulous shaman in Daytona Beach. I'm doing much better now, but I still have jagged nights and rough days, and I am still incontinent, though my therapists say that if I continue on the trajectory that I'm on, pretty soon I should be able to use the bathroom the way I used to use the bathroom, and I'm really looking forward to that. Another of my therapists suggested that to spend my time here on the vineyard in a productive way, I should do a podcast, and that is what you are listening to, and I'm so glad that you're here. You can find me on Instagram at Duncan Trussell. Right now, I'm just posting the exact same picture of a stone next to one of the trees outside of my father's vineyard, and I've been doing that ever since last summer. You might think it's the same picture of the stone, but I'm just taking it at the same time, and if the lighting's different, I use Photoshop to make the stone look exactly the same. Also, I'm at Duncan Trussell on Twitter. Follow me there if you are interested in daily multiple many updates on the state of my NFT library. Hi! Wow, do we have a fantastic podcast for you today. Jay Anderson is a UFO researcher. Not just that, he dives into a lot of other paranormal topics, occurrences, and happenings. And I've been following him on Twitter for a long time. He's one of my go-to sources if I'm trying to catch up on what's going on in the world of UAPs, UFOs, whatever you want to call them. Highly recommend following him on Twitter. It's Project Unity on Twitter, and he's got a YouTube channel of the same name with fantastic interviews that are rational, logical, informative, and of course, super weird, which is why we love the topic. And these days, you really do need some like main set of data feeds because there's so much weird stuff flying around out there, and it keeps getting weirder, and it keeps getting parsed by lots of different people, and so you can end up feeling confused and maybe even want to disconnect from all of it, which is why I keep my eyes on Project Unity's Twitter, along with Jeremy Corbell and a few others, just so I get a nice, well-rounded, non-wobbly analysis of what's going on out there. This is a great podcast. What I really loved about it is Jay opened up about an actual encounter that he had with UAPs using Dr. Stephen Greer's consciousness shifting techniques. I know all of this stuff might sound absolutely batshit to some of you, and I don't blame you. It is weird, but now that we have some verified former intelligence officers whistleblowing that maybe we have wreckage, that maybe we have ships, that maybe all of the stuff that we've been compulsively rejecting might be a little more true than we thought it was, we have to reframe the way we listen to people when they tell us about extraordinary experiences they've had with UFOs. And there are so many people out there who have had that experience, and they're all over the planet, and they've been telling different versions of the same story for thousands and thousands of years. You can follow me on Patreon. I'm at patreon.com/DTFH. You'll get commercial-free episodes of the DTFH, along with a weekly meditation and gathering and access to our wonderful Discord server and a community of brilliant, beautiful people, your family. And we are calling you home. But before you do that, strap in and get ready to have your third eye inflated, expanded, extantiated, and transformed into a gleaming, happy, glowing ball of metaphysical light. Here he is, folks. It's Project Unity, AKA Jay Anderson. Jay, welcome to the DTFH. Thank you so much. It's so nice to meet you in person. I've been following your Twitter and your YouTube channel for quite some time now, and I'm really happy to meet you in person-ish, digitally.
Duncan, as I said before, it's a great pleasure. I'm a big fan, so I'm really happy to get into this with you.
So, you know, I have a few like go-to data streams when weird shit is going on, and your Twitter feed is one of them. You do such a good job of not just like broadcasting or signal boosting relevant stuff that's going on in the world of fringe theories or just odd happenings, but also I love your commentary on it. I just love people who in the midst of the stuff that is happening right now can maintain a level-headed, rational attitude towards it without, you know, getting too sucked in to one thing or the other. I mean, I think that's what we all need to work on, because it's very easy to get spun out. But before we start talking about what I know you're interested in it because you've been tweeting about it, and I certainly am. I'm curious, what shifted you from probably being someone who's interested in these sorts of phenomena and things to becoming somebody who is a mouthpiece and who is a kind of a thought leader in this when it comes to these things? What happened? When did you think, you know what, I'm going live with this stuff?
Yeah, it's a funny one, Duncan. I mean, like, I've always been a very curious person and a bit of a daydreamer when I was a kid, you know. I think the primary sentence from each teacher was, he'd be great if he just applied himself, you know, because I was always just off in the clouds and thinking about other things. But, you know, I always had like a basic curiosity. But what actually happened to me was I had my own experiences. And the way in which that path unfolded for me, which then led to me being in the UFO research field, is inherently a spiritual path. And that's what really fascinates me about the UFO subject, is there's these, once you kind of dig underneath the nuts and bolts and the vehicles and the potential of alien life and civilizations, there's a very strange correlation with consciousness, higher states of consciousness. It bleeds into the psychedelic experience, the transcendental meditation experience. So to take you back a little bit, so I'm 28 years old now, and when I was in university, in my third year of university, in fact, you know what, Duncan, I'm going to close this window, and if I start getting sweaty, I will just open it again, because I can hear my neighbors brewing up for a barbecue.
Okay, if it's bugging you, that's fine, but I'm not picking that up.
Okay,
so,
all right. Well, no worries. If it gets too hot,
for
I will...
For folks listening, he's roasting out there
I'm
in
roasting.
The UK.
It is rarely hot in the UK, and we don't have AC in our houses or anything like that, so we're woefully unprepared for the sun.
Brutal.
It's gorgeous, though, but yeah, if it gets too sweaty, I'll open the window again. But yeah, to take you back, I was in my third year of university, and everything was just kind of falling apart, like... My friendships at the time were kind of breaking down. My relationship with my girlfriend at the time was breaking down. And just, it seemed like a kind of culminative series of events where it was just overwhelming. And it put me into quite a significant depression. And interestingly enough, being in the UFO research field now, there is some interesting correlation with trauma and having anomalous or paranormal experiences. So I'm not sure if it's definitive, but there certainly seems to be a correlation. But either way, I was in a bad spot. And my dad, you know, I think my mom and dad, they were both worried about me. They both knew that I was not in the right state of mind. And my dad was out in France at the time. And he was like, hey, look, I want you to come out. You know, I'll pay for your train ticket. Come over and stay with me for a week and just detox, just relax, just, you know, let the pressure out. So I went over to France, and when I was there, he said, look, I've got this series of books that I've been listening to that I really think would be good for you, and I really think you should listen to them. I've got them on audiobook. And at the time, I was like, oh god, you know, like, this isn't gonna help me, like, I'm like, a book isn't gonna magically just change the way that I feel right now. And anyway, I gave,
especially a book your dad likes,
right? It's like,
come on, dad.
Like, you know, this isn't gonna fix my problems. But either way, I gave him a chance. And you might know about them. It's a series of books called Conversations with God by Neil Donald Walsh.
Yes, I do know about them. Actually, I think my mom was into that act, and I read a little bit. I liked it. It's really cool.
Yeah. Well, it was the first catalyst for me that introduced a different concept of God, more like a universal consciousness type of thing, rather than just a, you know, a deity in the sky, which I just always had an issue with. I grew up like kind of semi-Christian. We went to Sunday school and stuff like that, but it wasn't super strict. But I never had that realistic concept of God in my mind until I read these books. And these books were the first thing that just kind of allowed me to phase out of this depression and see life in a slightly different way. It sent me down quite a novel route of being interested in these types of issues. So I started researching different areas of philosophy, different layman areas of quantum mechanics, and seeing the kind of correlations between these things and becoming very interested in that. No UFOs at this point, just a kind of more expansive interest in novel ideas about reality and this type of thing. So for about 2 years, going down that route of just kind of coalescing information and having some at least what felt like personal realizations about consciousness, our wider reality, what we really are as human beings. And then I ended up basically in another depression, and as is life, right? Just kind of a up and down journey. I found myself in another situation where basically now I felt like, all right, correlated all these different bits of information. I've come to some, you know, personal realizations about the grandiosity of reality, but what does this do for me? What does this actually do for my life? I'm still not really that happy. Yeah. I've still got a lot of stresses. You know, all this ethereal, ephemeral, philosophical stuff is great, but it's not really benefiting me in my real life. So I was sitting on my bed this one night, and I just, you know, you could call it a prayer. I just kind of said out loud to the universe, like, just give me something. Give me something that is representative of all these things I've been learning. Give me something I can do with my hands, something real, you know? Please just, you know, give me this thing that would make all of these ideas click into place. And then about a week later, my best friend, who has also been like this kind of strange intertwining agent on both of our journeys of understanding spirituality or consciousness, we've both assisted each other in different ways on that journey. My best friend, a week after this request I made to the universe, came to me and he was like, dude, you got to check out this this documentary. I was like, oh, what is it? He said, it's called Unacknowledged by Dr. Stephen Greer. And I'd never heard of Dr. Stephen Greer. And now I know he is quite a polarizing figure in the UFO community, but there is a lot of value to the man, despite some of his egotistical tendencies. Yeah. You know, this does definitely create a bit of a wide divide in the research field. However, I'd never heard of him. So I was coming in blind. I was seeing all of these, you know, Minutemen missile operator, nuclear launch facility guys coming out on the record talking about objects coming over and shutting down nuclear silos, and they were showing the documentation. And so it was a good introduction into the UFO field, and it made me recognize, actually, there's some pretty serious people here that are talking about this. Okay, I'm interested, I'm listening. But it was at the end of that documentary where Greer introduces this concept that he's coined as CE5, which is essentially methodologies for initiating a form of contact with these non-human intelligences.
I just read about this.
Well, you're going to love it.
I've just read about this with Greer. Yeah, go ahead. I didn't know that aspect of Greer. Yep. And I do know the controversy around Greer. My feeling right now is like all hands on deck, mm-hmm. you know, and it's subjectively a person's job to sort of differentiate the personality from the data stream
and find the
coherence among other people who are saying similar things and just disregard whatever the personal stuff is that's like giving you the ick.
Right.
You know,
right.
It doesn't mean the data is necessarily wrong. And I think he's done some great work out there for the UFO field, and he deserves some credit for that regardless of personal bullshit.
He's been in the game for decades, man. And, you know, I've been in this for about 5 years and I'm already paranoid and freaked out and not trusting many people. So, you know, it's a pretty tough terrain to navigate coming through this, especially when you're dealing with the intelligence community and all the kind of mixed match of messages that come from these people, individuals who want to try and lead you down a certain route, which I've certainly had experience with. But Dr. Greer presents this concept of CE5. And, you know, CE5, essentially, if I boil it down for people, is different methodologies, usually involving some form of meditation practice or just a basic sense of meditation, getting into a clear, calm, coherent state of mind, bringing up positive energies and projecting the intention that you want something to respond to this. And, you know, this gets into all sorts of non-locality of consciousness, quantum physics types of conversations, the further you dig down into it. But this was, for me, when it was being introduced, I immediately went back to that night on my bed asking the universe, you know, can give me something that I can do that proves all of these exotic concepts.
Right.
Suddenly here's a guy saying, hey, you want proof of these things? Just get into a calm state of mind, go outside and start, you know, projecting your intentions. And the deeper I've dug into this field, the more I've come to the realization that that type of contact, it is real. But it seems to require very strong intention, a setting aside of disbelief, and a genuine belief in your own capabilities as a conscious vehicle. If you don't have these types of beliefs, it seems much like many other ritualistic behaviors, the actual effect doesn't take place if you're not believing that the actual ritual itself is worthwhile.
Right.
So for me, because I'd had what felt like this weird confirmatory message from the universe, dude, I became like a zealot at that point. I was fully like, this is an answer. I started going out into my backyard, and it was in the summertime, luckily, so it was pretty warm. And I started getting into these calm, meditative states of mind, very basic as well, which was such a realization to me. It's what really sparked me wanting to make my YouTube channel was I was like, dude, I'm not a meditation expert. And this happened. So anyone can do this. Anyone can do this. Oh my God, I need to tell people. So that was
what happened.
So, okay. Initially, and I think that this is some form of a progression of sorts, because it starts off lightly and then it did result in some pretty spectacular things occurring. So it started off, and I've always been someone who looks up at the stars. So I know what satellites look like, shooting stars, meteorites, you know, I've always been a stargazer. What I first noticed was a drastic increase in the amount of what looked like satellites traversing over. So it would be a crystal clear sky, but within about 10 minutes, I'd seen upwards of 30 of these white orbs coming over in different directions.
Wow.
And that was enough for me to be like, you know, something's happening here. Like, this isn't normal. I don't usually see this many. So I started going out pretty much every single night within this summertime period in 2019, around August, June, July, and August. And for maybe a few weeks, it was this type of influx of white satellite-looking orbs. Then some of these white satellite-looking orbs, as they were traversing, would begin to glow, 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 and then flash, and then come back down again very slowly, as if it was like this kind of flashbulb effect, which is what it's commonly called in the whole contact community, which is a fringe below the fringe. So it's like a subculture within the already fringe topic of UFOs are these crazy people who say that they can contact them with their mind. And, you know, that's not very easy to take on board if you're a skeptic of the UFO subject in general. Then you've got this added layer of like, oh, yeah, and you can also bring them in with your consciousness. However,
what else can you call birds? Right? Squirrels?
Yeah, exactly, right? Yeah, exactly, dude. It's like the worst type of thing you can tell a skeptic, and especially if you tell them, and you have to believe in it for it to work. And they're like, oh, of course you do. Yeah, thank you, buddy.
So it's like Elf on the Shelf. Is that what it's like?
Dude, honestly, the amount of conversations I've had to have on that to try and justify my position on this. But either way, white orbs coming over in a higher frequency than I'm used to, then they start glowing and flashing. And this would be maybe three or four times. So it would come across the sky, it would start to glow, it would flash, it would bring itself back down. And then I would, in my mind at least, send some form of confirmatory thought, like, hey, are you here for me? Are you here for me? Flash, another quick bright flash. And it seemed to be responsive to what I was projecting towards it. So that to me was another step up on the belief scale of like, okay, this is something that's not normal. I haven't seen this before. But to kind of skip ahead, the experiences that I ended up having in August in 2019, and I had four of them, really solidified my belief that I had to start putting my face on the camera, talking about these experiences, seeing if other people were out there. Because I was in my backyard, which is literally just out there, and I was at the back of my garden looking towards the house, looking up at the sky, again, crystal clear sky, beautiful evening, probably about, I don't know, 10 o'clock, 10:30 at night. And I was doing what at this point had become my usual routine, which was to just get into this state, start projecting these thoughts and intentions, and just scanning the sky and seeing what turns up. And there were some flashes. I saw a flash of white light in a void of space, and I looked up and put my attention on it. And then I saw it again, another flash in the same spot, and then another flash, and then another flash. And it was just a static flash that was no discernible object attached to it, just a static flash, flash, flash like that every second and a half. And I was watching this, and it lasted for about 5 minutes or so, to the point where I was just like, okay, well, that's great. I'm going to keep looking around. Like, thank you for being here, whatever you are. I'm going to keep scanning the skies. And I panned my head over, and there was a cloud floating across the sky. And I did a bit of a double take. I looked at this cloud, I kept looking back, and then I looked back at this cloud. And it was when I looked back at it the second time that I realized that there was something not right with this cloud, because it's kind of hard to describe, but it was quite dark. It's quite a dark looking cloud. It looked like it had this light overlay of TV static, like there was a fuzz.
Wow.
Some sort of kind
weird,
of fuzzy, disruption-y field that was occurring. And when I noticed that, I was like, okay, this is weird. What is this? Kept my eyes on it. If this is my house and I'm at the back of my garden looking towards my house, this cloud is basically in a trajectory where it's going to drift past my house and keep going off from basically from left to the right. And I'm at the back. This cloud gets to basically from my line of sight directly aligned with my house. And it does a complete right angle turn. It like an abrupt jolting change of its direction. And now it's coming towards me. So it's up in the air, but eventually it's going to be above my head. It's slowly making its way over to me. When I saw it do this 90 degree change, dude, like my heart skipped a beat. Like I was kind of stunned and locked in place, a bit like a rabbit in headlights. Like I couldn't really move. I was just staring at this thing and knowing that it was eventually going to be directly above my head. So it got directly above my head. Duncan, I swear on everything I love in this world, this is the truth, what just happened to me. This cloud, as it got directly above me, it just sucked into itself. Like it just went like that. And inside it was a triangle formation of about 25, maybe 30 orange balls of light in a perfect triangle formation.
Wow.
It didn't stop. So as it happened directly above me, I had to turn my head and watch as this triangle just went off into the distance. And I could, as I was staring at it, I could see that some of these lights were like swapping places in the formation. They were like changing spots in the formation. So I don't think it was a solid craft. I think it was literally, dude, like a squadron of orange orbs, you know.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
it's hard to believe, but I swear to God, like
I believe
this
you.
Happened to me. And like, dude, the first person I phoned was my mom. It was, she was at like a restaurant or something. I just phoned my mom, like, you're not gonna believe, oh my God, I saw these orange orbs. She thought I'd had a psychotic breakdown, dude. You know, like they believe me now that I've had like, you know, CIA officers and Pentagon program directors on my podcast. They're taking it a little bit more seriously, but I think it was pretty hard to digest at the beginning. But yeah, that propelled me into knowing that this is real. I don't know what they are. I wouldn't ever say definitively, oh yeah, these are the Arcturians from the stars. You know, I don't know anything.
Right.
I wasn't given telepathic messaging, didn't get any downloads, but they responded to a coherent signal from the human body, which to me says so much about not only the non-local capacity of human consciousness, the idea that consciousness is a field, we're immersed in it and focalized as one kind of crystalline aspect of consciousness, but that it's actually an all-pervasive field. It certainly seems suggestive that that's the case. And the fact that there are intelligences out there, man, we don't know what they are, but they pick up on these subtle frequencies that we produce. And I kind of look at the human being as a bio-quantum computational system. We're like a computer, a quantum computer, biological. We have these incredibly sophisticated and intricate instruments for analyzing information and rendering reality, and we may even be responsible for collapsing the photon and the electron into its particle state, as is shown in things like the double slit experiment. So we're these very interesting creatures, and there are other things out there. This is what was demonstrated to me. There are other things out there, and it certainly, especially amongst all of the talk right now with the UFO field, which is very bureaucratic and kind of military industrial complex orientated, national security threats and sovereign airspace, and you know, these things are intruding on our sensitive sites. And for me, there's this other side of it where it's like, hey, look, you get yourself into a grounded, peaceful, open, loving, intentional state, and some of these things turn up. And that says to me that there's room for optimism as well, that there's benevolence out there. But I'll let you respond in a second, but real quick, as I said, I had four experiences with these orange orbs. On two other occasions, they flew across the skyline in different formations, like a W formation with a couple of them trailing off at the back and a V formation with a couple of them trailing off at the back. Just very quick traversals as I was outside, they just kind of flew by. I saw it in my periphery, looked up and just caught this little formation of orange orbs flying across the sky. But it was the third, so I had four experiences, but it was the third experience where they came down close. And so I was, again, out in my garden, same routine, same type of thing, getting into these states. And I saw a flash of color in my peripherals. I looked up to the left and three of these orbs are flying across the sky in like a little formation, these three orbs. They stop on a dime, high up, but they stop on a dime right above my house. And then as I was looking at them, I noticed that they were descending. And they were coming down, and they were doing this weird weaving. They were like weaving around each other like this, very hypnotic and kind of calming. And they came down and froze about 5 feet above the roof of my house. They were roughly basketball sized, this kind of pastel light orange color, slightly transparent. And something I didn't think about at the time, but I've looked back on and realized, is that they weren't giving off light. There was no kind of light dissipation onto the roof. The roof wasn't glowing. It was like a self-contained light somehow. Nothing was spilling out of it. And they froze above the roof of my house for maybe a few seconds. Then they suddenly started moving again, and they began this routine of moving around each other. They went up, and they literally floated over to my neighbor's garden over there and froze again. And I couldn't think. There was no thoughts going on in my brain. I wish I could have at that time, because obviously I'm getting into these meditative states and I'm like trying to send a message. Then they turn up and you just turn into an idiot because you're just like, like, you know, have no space in your mind for what's really happening. So I had no intelligent ambassador type of welcome to Earth message. I was just staring at them with a dumbstruck face. But then, after like 3 seconds of being frozen over my neighbor's garden, they just suddenly started moving again. They went up and up and up and up and up and up until I couldn't see them. And I haven't seen them since.
You know, one thing I think that's worth considering is people think because they don't have the telepathic communication or the download that they aren't talking, there isn't a conversation happening. But, you know, in this, as above, so below, the human psyche is such that we have an entire swath of our identities, what they call the subconscious. We don't know what's going on there.
And
who knows what conversation you were having with him? Your waking mind might not have been aware of what was going on, but I do think that they probably did talk to you. Maybe the reason you became who you are and started doing what you're doing was not just because you saw it, but because there was a deeper sort of soul level communication happening.
I almost attribute it to a psychedelic experience. There's like a neural genesis that seems to occur when you have a contact like this, because it's so outside of your parameters of normal. Much like a psychedelic experience, it throws you into being forced to embrace abstract and wider types of concepts. And so I think that there is, in some way, some level of neurological shift that might occur, and maybe the brain either accepts or rejects what it's seeing. And if you reject it, you just kind of shovel it in the filing cabinet. If you accept it, you start embracing a new type of reality. And dude, literally, I just got my camera phone. I went to the forest near me where no one could hear me, where my neighbors couldn't hear me. I put the camera on the tree branch and I just started talking about my experiences and telling people it was real and encouraging people to get into these states. And everything about my life now unfolded from those experiences. So when people say to me, it's what, dude, honestly, the life journey for me on a subjective level has just made me feel like there really is an inherent intelligence embedded into nature, and that things move and assist you, and that you respond to life, life responds back to you, manifestation is real to a certain degree. And it just changed everything about my life. I mean, I was a rock climbing instructor before I was in this field. So I was just not in this type of space whatsoever, just in a different type of world. And all of these doors opened up for me from them. So like you, I agree that these orbs, if their language is alien, it's the language of experience. Like the way they spoke to me is by unfolding an experience for me.
Right. And trusting that you had the capacity to deal with it, because perhaps they know some people don't need to be diverted. They don't need to deal with this extra layer of reality that is now seemingly being confirmed by world governments. You know, there's a story in a documentary, and I can't remember the name of it. I'll get it for you. It's a documentary about Neem Karoli Baba, Ram Dass's guru. And so as this story goes, they were hanging out by this like mountain in India that's considered to be the sacred mountain. And all of a sudden these orbs appear. And, you know, one of his followers was like, we've got to get a camera. We've got to film this. We have to get a camera. And he like just laughed. And he's like, do you want people to say I can call orbs? Is that what you want? But for, it's just what you're saying. For him, this was normal because of where his consciousness was. And these things do seem to show up around certain people to the point where it's like verifiable.
Yeah.
And it is so bizarre, so outlandish. You can't judge anyone for hearing your story or the story I just told or any of the countless stories out there and being like, that is complete nonsense. We can't blame anybody for their skepticism. No. You should be skeptical. But I think one thing that we do know is that people are having these experiences that aren't charlatans, that aren't doing some stupid hoax. So to me, one way that I like to contemplate what these stories and the UFO or whatever you want to call it phenomena is by looking at what evidence we do have. Not like evidence pictures and all the stuff we will have pretty soon, but the impact on humanity as a whole. In other words, the human biome has within it a strata of people whose lives have been changed, sometimes not for the better, by contact with whatever these things are. And there is a coherence to the stories. There is a repeating patterns. There are so many, not just like you could argue, okay, yeah, sure. Well, that's just because you hear a story and then you hallucinate it or you want to see it. But historically, you look back and it's the same thing throughout time. And I agree with you that the conversation around UFOs has to have consciousness within it, has to have an acknowledgement that we might share a consciousness, not just with each other, not just a planetary consciousness, but a universal consciousness. A kind of, you know, if we are made of, if everything that we're made of at some point came from the Big Bang, then we're entangled. We're entangled with the very first moment of time. We are, and this solves a lot of the problem of, traveling faster than light speed, because what did Einstein call it? Spooky physics.
Action at a distance.
The way that you can.
Spooky action at a distance.
Yeah, spooky action. This seems to overcome the speed of light and seems impossible, but within that, you see a mechanism where potentially, or a medium, I guess you could say, through which these things could travel and thus be anywhere they want to be instantaneously.
Well, this is what's fascinating about the time we live in, Duncan, because even recently I saw a study that demonstrated they'd created a macro quantum event, a scalable quantum event, meaning that the strange behavior that occurs on that quantum level of life, we've always considered it very difficult or perhaps even impossible to scale those effects up to our world. But we've recently had, I can't remember the university that published it, but they created a type of structure that has basically proved Schrodinger's cat theory real. It was in two quantum states at once. And that's not something we've ever been able to do. So you look at the way that we're moving with quantum computation and quantum physics. You look at the way we're moving with artificial intelligence, even sophisticated consciousness studies like the DMTX London Imperial College London trial that happened recently, where they were probing into and mapping the realm of the DMT space. We're getting very sophisticated data about things that we once considered to be extremely exotic sci-fi types of concepts. So you think about this strange deep trench within the UFO field of this entanglement with consciousness. And right now it's still considered relatively woo-woo and, and, you know, pseudoscientific, but we are fast approaching a quantum era. And I think within that, and I have to believe, because it's just part of my optimism, I have to believe that technological advancement will assist us in spiritual advancement, because that's where we're going. That's where we've cashed our chips, right? We've cashed our chips as a human species in technological progression pretty much above all else. Yeah. And you go, you know, you go back to the dawn of time. Ever since we first sharpened a stick into a spear, we have been propagating technology. That's part of our influence, is that we have this ability to create intellectual tools that further propel and accelerate us through evolutionary time. We're like nothing else on this planet in that regard. So if you could zoom out from the trenches of the human experience, you might be able to see the mosaic we're creating through evolution. And I think, at least the way that I try and see it, is that early human history was very shamanistic. And we moved from that with the Age of Enlightenment and Newtonian reductionism and all these kind of dusty academics saying, oh, it's just solid matter. There's... We moved into this more technical, analytical realm. I would like to think that we're now moving into something that I call techno-shamanism, which is this idea that these two worlds are going to meld together, that we're going to have science and spirit, or physics and metaphysics, logic and intuition, meld together. And the more sophisticated our technology gets into piercing into reality, the more likely these are to meet in the middle. And that's my optimism. If everyone's freaking out about AI and the, you know, the global stage, and I understand, but I genuinely think we might be on the precipice of a transformation of the human species, at least in terms of our way of looking at reality and responding to reality. So I think we're on the edge, man. I think we're on the edge of taking that woo-woo pseudoscience and realizing, these are components of reality. And we're like Jedi with amnesia.
And if you look into some of the most impactful, at least the ones I'm aware of, so some of the most famous scientists in the world, of Nikola Tesla being one of them, they were mystical. Like Tesla had a vision from which emerged the technology that has transformed the modern world. And look at Parsons at JPL, you know, he pals with Crowley. Similarly, there's craters on the moon named after him. So I think that sort of in default reality, there is an assumption that is incorrect regarding the minds of the people who brought us some of the greatest technologies in the world.
Yeah. They're basically mystic channelers. Yeah, yes. They're channelers, you know.
right. So that's where, and I get it. It's like, you know, I think, If you kind of look at capitalism as a womb that is growing these like potentially spiritual technologies that will, you know, create a benevolent transformation, that womb weirdly requires these sort of like acolytes or disciples of matter who don't need to be lost in the idea of like, you know, angelic beings that we're now calling aliens, or spiritual entities that we're now calling aliens. But really, they do need to be in default reality. They want to be in default reality. And I guess the only problem there is they have this weird passion about defending default reality as being the only possible reality. But to pull that off, they can't really look into the people who have constructed the technologies allowing default reality to exist, because then the rug gets pulled out from under them, right? Now they're really fucked. So now there's nowhere to hold on to at that point. So you don't investigate Tesla. You don't investigate Oppenheimer, who quoted the Bhagavad Gita when the nuclear bomb went off. And that says everything about Oppenheimer. He was reading the Gita. You don't look into what was spiritually feeding these people. And you can enjoy this nice three-dimensional space-time stuff with air conditioning. Well, not for you, but air conditioning, TVs.
Yeah.
And there's something comfortable about that.
One of the best cases of that is one of the founding fathers of rationalism, René Descartes, because, you know, René Descartes basically laid down the principles on which a lot of these very skeptical, reductionist, rationalist types of minds will then debunk, you know, an anomalous phenomena. But what they conveniently miss out is the fact that René Descartes was given the foundational principles of rationalism by an angel. At least that was his interpretation. So he was in a fevered dream. It was out in Prague. He'd enlisted in the army at that time. He was sleeping in a fever state. And he had an angel, or at least what he interpreted to be an angel, come and visit him in this fevered state. And it said something along the lines of, if you wish to understand the universe, you must think in terms of measurement and number. And this inspired René Descartes to basically lay down the foundations of what now is used to debunk anomalous phenomena. So the irony of that is just the cherry on top of the cake, you know?
Well, I think one way to look at it would be, it's like, imagine the human species is like sailors who don't want to admit that there's something under the water. They want to imagine it's just surface level stuff. And the stuff under the water is all the stuff that comes into the human consciousness field that we call inspiration. And that inspiration is what gives us everything. That's where all the ideas come from. Everything comes from that. And somehow people don't want to, it seems like people don't want to, again, I always go back to as above, so below. It's like, in some ways you could argue that like certain ideas are UFOs. Certain ideas are UFOs flying into your subjective world from the vastness of your unconscious mind. And if you instantiate those ideas into reality, they will exist minus you. They go on to repeat themselves either mimetically or by, you know, technological duplication or you know, music or whatever. They inseminate the world and spread. And it's really funny to think that is what is going to lead us to, I think, what you're talking about and what many other people are talking about, that it's like the outer space and the inner space are working together. And in fact, like are probably the same thing. And here we are in the middle of these two things, just trying to figure out what we are. That's the other thing. We don't even know what we are. We're a mystery unto ourselves. That's the other thing. We don't even know what we are. We're a mystery unto ourselves.
Damn straight, bro. And that's what really, from a philosophical perspective, really interests me about the UFO. The UFO is almost a representation of that microcosm and macrocosm, because you have the spaceship, you have the vehicle, you have the idea of an alien species, but then it penetrates through the web of consciousness. It goes through dimensions that we don't even think are real. It influences different life events and brings you towards it. At least that's what happened to me, is it felt like my life events were unraveling, and it was only when I had those contact situations that I look back and go, oh my God, like it was like I was led to this. It was like life moved me to it. And so this is the fascinating kind of duality of these things. They're not just solid state vehicles. It's not just matter. It's mind. It's mind and matter. It's that symbiosis between spirit and science that I was talking about in terms of my hopes for humanity hanging above us in the skies like a shadow of our future human potential. This is what happens if you combine this hemisphere and this hemisphere in perfect sophistication. You have a vehicle that can not only traverse the dimensions of time and space, it can traverse the dimensions of consciousness, of whatever that really means. This is in some ways a spiritual vehicle, and that's what really gives me this kind of passion to understand it, because it's not as cut and dry as people think. And you know, I've got a friend of mine who was a leading UK defense analyst, and he worked for some of these very good, you know, top tier companies. He was the editor of a publishing company called Jane's Defense Weekly, which is like this big defense mag. Very nuts and bolts, analytical orientated guy. He's now on the Bigelow Institute for Consciousness Studies board.
Wow.
And is completely immersed in the concept of this being entangled with human consciousness, with human spirit. So the deeper you dig, the more time you spend on the UFO subject, you inescapably end up at this weird metaphysical, spiritual, conscious soup. And it's fascinating, mate.
It's funny that seems surprising. You know, and it's funny that when people do veer off into the spiritual angle when it comes to UFOs, they get discredited even within the UFO community.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And this speaks towards our sort of blindness that we have. Some people, they have narrowed their view, and they expect UFOs to conform in some way with human technology, or the aliens should be limited. I mean, some of the comments you like with the current revelations coming out regarding, you know, the visitations by these things, you know, one of the arguments that weirdly pops up is, well, there's no way, because the closest planet and the speed of light, and there's no way. And it's like, these are, you're talking about a question mark, but you're ascribing to the question mark limitations based on terrestrial technology and the human limitation. And if it doesn't fit in with like Einstein's theories, then it can't be possible. It's not possible. And to me, that's just so odd that people fervently into the UFO or UAP or whatever you want to call it field seem to refuse to acknowledge that there might be some novelty at work here that is so different than anything we could ever understand that we can't even see it. Maybe that is the reason, if you do the Greer meditation prescription, that suddenly you start seeing these things. It's not that you're calling them as much as you're sort of wiping some dust off the windshield and seeing what's there all the time.
Almost widening the bandwidth. Yeah, like widening the bandwidth of your perception, you know. And that's another thing, dude. Like, people forget that we exist on the visible light spectrum of experience. Like, you know, there is a whole spectrum that is completely invisible to us. We can't see infrared and ultraviolet in extreme precision with our eyes. Like, this tiny, tiny little slice of default sensory experience is being used as the kind of explanatory blueprint for everything.
Yes.
It's like, that's not fair. You can't do that because we're limited by our perception. So we're going to be limited with the kind of models we can create for reality. And as you said, you know, this usage of either like the Fermi paradox, or, you know, great filters, or the speed of light restrictions, the distance between stars and planets, this is the territory of, you know, Brian Cox or Neil deGrasse Tyson or some of these people that go, oh, well, I think because of these restrictions. But it's a human template. on something that is inherently not human,
right,
and may have had a whole lot longer to advance. And also I leave the door very wide open to multidimensional intelligences in this subject. I don't think it's necessarily just, you know, aliens from a planet in another star system. I think this could incorporate some very novel ideas about intelligences from other dimensions. And the fact that you have bleed through in psychedelic, near-death experience, transcendental meditation, and UFO experiences, there are correlatory archetypes that appear in all of these different modes of getting into a higher state of consciousness. So a higher state of consciousness is the keystone. That's the underpinning keystone. It's represented in all these different practices. These archetypes show themselves in all these different practices. Yes. So I think there's probably an alien element. I doubt we're the only ones on a dirt ball floating through space. I'm sure there are plenty of those, but I think... And I do think with the kind of contact modalities we were discussing, which led to me having my experiences, I don't think that's alien. I think it's, I mean, it's alien to us, but I don't think it's that typical traditional thing. I do think it could be something that we might call spiritual or at least metaphysical or ultra dimensional. And, you know, I've spoken to some incredible people during my time in this field. I mean, honestly, it's such a wild journey. Like I said, I went from setting up a camera on a tree branch to... you know, flying to Florida to meet a former director of special projects for Los Alamos National Labs. And, you know, these like incredible people who have had exposure to this type of issue internally. And, you know, this individual in question, this Los Alamos projects manager, you know, he was like, I think it's just interdimensional. I think this is a higher dimensional object coming into our reality. And we're just seeing a little slice. And he compared it to, what's that book? Flatland? Have you heard of Flatland?
Yeah, sure. But why don't you describe it to the listeners?
Well, Flatland is quite a small book, but it's basically the whole book is premised around the idea that this three-dimensional object comes into a two-dimensional reality. So Flatland is a two-dimensional reality. Everyone exists on that dimension. And it's about this, you know, three-dimensional object coming in and how it's perceived and how people respond to it. And this individual, Oak Shannon, from Los Alamos, he kind of gave the same idea that these things that we're seeing, this could just be a little slice of a higher dimensional object and we're not getting the full picture. I certainly think there's an element of that represented in the UFO field, alongside what could genuinely just be spaceship from another dimension or another part of space even. You know, they're working on these things. You've got David Grush coming out as the whistleblower recently saying that we've got multiple intact non-human exotic vehicles that are being studied. And this is nothing new to the UFO research field. I mean, you know, most people in the field who've done their due diligence are looking at groups like Lockheed Martin and Raytheon and Boeing and with wary eyes, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base and all these different corners of the national security architecture that, at least from historical reference, it would seem, one, sequestered materials and studied them, and the even more easy to trace history is the obsession with anti-gravity, electrogravitics, novel propulsion, exotic energy. Like, there is a paper trail, especially in the 1950s. It's very strange because it kind of looks like in the 1950s, a lot of mainstream physics was looking at anti-gravity or gravity generation or manipulation as the next logical step.
Right.
It was the next logical step, and then it just stopped. And you can literally see this in the history where labs got shut down or scientists just disappeared off the grid. And so these types of companies had a vested interest in pouring millions and millions, maybe even billions, into these types of novel gravity generation types of systems. And to think that they haven't made any sort of advancement in that area with 70 plus years worth of black budget money being poured into it off the books, I think that's very unlikely. So there's also the possibility that some of these things we're looking at in the sky and thinking, oh my God, that must be an alien spaceship, could actually be a Lockheed Martin platform of some form that we're just not ever disclosed to the public.
Yes. That I think is like, to me, certainly one of the more logical explanations or that they're, you know,
because UFOs, it makes a perfect cover, right? UFOs are a perfect cover. Oh, that's just a, you know, it's just a UFO.
A perfect way to simultaneously test your vehicles while discounting completely that they're yours. And definitely a wonderful way to send messages to your enemies who are probably smart enough to be like, that's not a fucking UFO. What do they have? What is that? wait, they're shutting down their nuclear silo? How are they doing that? That's not a UFO. I think that with Grush in particular, did you watch the of course you did. You watched the interview. And I don't, what was the name of the interviewer? What was his name?
So Ross is a good friend of mine, Ross Coltart. He's a Australian investigative reporter, very well known in Australia, and
he did such a good job.
Has blown up. Yeah, well, he's great. I mean, not to toot my own horn, but I got the first interview of that dude back in 2021. I got introduced to him just as he was getting his toes wet in the UFO field, and we've got a little chat group where we spoke over the years. And we did the first interview where he was highlighting some of these things, and a couple of them I've reposted onto my YouTube channel in light of all of this reverse engineering program hype, just to remind people what the dude was saying. Because 2 years ago, back in 2021, he was saying the same things about his sources being, giving him this type of information. He had one of the things, and I'm sorry to derail him, I'm sure you were going to ask about Dave Grush, but just one quick tidbit with Ross. Someone that he managed to meet, who unfortunately passed away, and one of the reasons why the guy reached out to Ross was because he knew he was dying. He was dying of cancer. He was the former director of the U.S. Navy's entire science and technology division. He was the head guy, a guy called Nat, N-A-T, Kobitz, K-O-B-I-T-Z. And he got in touch with Ross, and they started a kind of friendship, and they met up a few times, and Ross didn't really push him on what he wanted to ask him until eventually this guy just went, Ross, why don't you just ask me what you really want to ask me? And he said, okay, Nat, were you ever read in to retrieval or reverse engineering programs relating to UFOs? And he said, yes. And he said that there had been multiple retrievals. This was like a couple years ago. So that, this is not the first time. And there's been so many high-level testimonies over the decades of people saying, yes, we have these programs, yes, we do have these vehicles. I think even if people have their doubts about Dave Grush right now, because it's early days and it's hard to know exactly what's happening, especially when you've got people coming from the intelligence architecture, it's difficult to trust, it's difficult to know what's really going on behind the scenes. But the acknowledgement from someone like Dave Grush and the official complaint to Congress and to the Inspector General, like that raises the bar a little bit. It's not just some guy making claims and not backing it up.
He could go to jail. I don't think people understand how valuable it is to have security clearance. How for people in the intelligence community, that's your bread and butter. And when you lose that, you're fucked. And so for someone like that to essentially throw their career away for a few interviews and to deal with, aside from the God knows what he's going through, just from the psychological warfare and threats coming from the intelligence community, but just to deal with the general, being marked as an idiot or a charlatan or someone having a psychotic break. It's not like what he's doing benefits him as a person in any way, at least in a way that's makes sense based on what the rest of his life is going to be like, assuming that other people don't start coming forward and he the dam breaks. So that sucks for him. But, one thing I do when I'm watching these interviews, or one thing I do, watching the hearings, the UFO hearings and stuff, is I look at the people doing the interview. And I think, because, it's easy to get caught up in Grush, but what's his name? Ross
Coltart, C-O-U-L-T-H-A-R-T, for anyone listening.
Now, obviously, I don't know this for sure, but I'm watching him and I'm thinking, oh, fuck. Grush, he showed him stuff that he's told him that he can't talk about. And he told him stuff that he said, you can't talk about this. And so I like to imagine I can see the weight of that information on these people's shoulders, because you can't fucking hide it. And the hearings, when you see these people after they get the debrief, they don't seem okay. They seem legitimately spun by this stuff. And from that, you can extrapolate a lot, because these people are being told stuff that does not fit in with default reality, and they're working through in their own minds how to ethically, morally continue to do their jobs with some of the information that they've been told. And you can see it on their faces. These are fucking politicians. They're trained to not get rattled. I mean, I'm sure you saw the interview, the hallway interview. What was his name?
Oh God, there's been a few of them now.
There's one who said, lock your doors. Do you see the lock your doors, lock your windows?
Yeah.
He gets the download. And you just look at his face. Just forget whether he's a Republican or a Democrat. Just know this is a trained politician who is not supposed to get rattled. He is rattled. And so I think you can learn a lot from that, because a lot of these people who are, and I do think it's a burden, which is why another reason people in the intelligence community don't tell some of us some of the things they might want to tell us, because they are having to deal with it in their own lives. And losing security clearance aside, they don't want to burden somebody with this shit, because it's a lot, I think, for them to deal with.
Dude, like, I really want to know the truth to this subject, but I do not envy people in extremely high classification levels in this subject, like within government. Like, that must be one of the toughest things, to be shouldered with this type of knowledge and to know you can't say anything about it because it's a national security secret. I mean, the amount of pressure, which is why, you know, I'm pretty fortunate. Like, I'm a young guy. I drifted into this from just putting a camera on a tree branch, but I've got some pretty amazing contacts these days, like within the intelligence community, within DC, people that are a little bit closer to the conversation that's happening, and I get little tidbits, bit of private information. Like, there are more whistleblowers. There are more whistleblowers. People who have got people who have had genuine access. Like, Grush is referring to all of the high-level senior sources that came to him, people who said they were in the program, you know, but it's secondhand testimony. What's happening under the surface level right now is there are first-hand testimony people ready to go and waiting to go. And, you know, the Whistleblower Protection Act, because for people that don't know, like, this year in the signing of the National Defense Authorization Act, the NDAA, was a series of legislative changes relating to UFOs. So you had this kind of like blanket coverage investigation, multi-agency investigation of all the information about UFOs going all the way back to 1945. That was kind of one of the legislative prerequisites for this year. And then there was the Whistleblower Protection Act, which is going to be put in place to essentially be a safeguard for people who are read into this subject on a actual kind of non-disclosure agreement level. They're in programs who are willing to come out. And that's Title 50 legislation, which is what David Grush is basically relying on to be safe and protected. The only issue with that is, and this is something that Ross has brought up and a few other people have brought up, is that even if it protects that individual, it doesn't protect that individual's family. Like, for example, if your son or daughter wanted to get a job in the intelligence community or in the military, that might not happen anymore, because you've basically been blacklisted as a problem.
Yeah.
So there are lots of factors at play that make people hesitant to come out. You know, I've spoken to some individuals who have relative levels of access that do not want to come out because they're worried about the ramifications that might occur for them, their family, etc. So there's a lot of pressure. There is a genuine raising of the temperature occurring right now with this subject, and I think it is this kind of ontological shock factor they're trying to avoid by just warming the water gradually and introducing more and more elements. From what I was told, and this was coming from someone who retired at a very high level within the intelligence community, I won't say which particular agency, but what I was told was that the non-human intelligence aspect of this has basically been greenlit, that the compartments that are being held in classified annexes are being greenlit to start opening up the doors, letting people know, yep, there is a non-human intelligence, there is technology, we do have that technology, but our capabilities is going to remain secret. Our capabilities is in the reverse engineering success, the potential success of being able to recreate these very exotic platforms, these very novel energy generation systems, the manipulation of space-time, the manipulation of gravity curvature. This stuff is not going to be public knowledge.
Right.
And so there is this non-human component, but you have to remember this, that there's a human component to this. And that's actually what worries me more than the non-human component, is the idea that we, the crazy monkeys, have, you know, space-time weaponry or something that's just too out there for you to really even comprehend.
Right. Well, I mean, again, this is truly spitballing, but...
Mm-hmm.
Okay, take, I think it was in it was one of Grush, someone told Grush, I think you probably know the source of this, you know, the story of like they had a 30 meter craft, but someone went inside, it was the size of a football stadium. You know what I'm talking about? What did, right. That came from Grush? Yep. Where'd that come, yep, from? Was that Grush?
I don't want to say it came from Grush because I don't think it did, but I know this. I heard the claim being floated around that there was this vehicle that was small in size, and you went inside it and it was gigantic, which again, you know, and that's actually a concept from Doctor Who. If anyone has heard of, yeah, Doctor Who, which is a very popular sci-fi British thing with a, you know, a flying police box that, you know, the Doctor would travel through, but you go inside it and it's just gigantic vehicle. And I suppose that could be some form of space-time dilation. It's very difficult, yeah, to wrap your head around the
who
concept
knows
of that.
Who knows? But yeah, that, you know, that spun me a little bit, because then I started thinking, what's to say we're not inside one of these things? What's to say if they're capable, right, of doing that, then we're in some kind of egg? What's to say we're not in some cosmic egg? I often go back to, I don't know, did you see the Grant Morrison? You know Grant Morrison is?
Yeah, yeah.
He wrote,
yeah,
The Invisibles. Did you see that rant he did at some conference where he was talking about?
No, I don't think so.
Oh, I will send it to you. It's incredible. He's like, clearly like, like hammered and high as a kite, which I think he admits to during it. But that certainly does nothing to slow down his brilliance. He's so brilliant, and
right, right. He's brilliant.
I think this is prior. I don't know if he came into contact with Greer or whatever, but essentially he was in Kathmandu on some hash and had made the decision he wanted to see these things. Like, there was the first, you have to ask. And, you know, weirdly, this is the, in like secret societies and some magical systems, mm-hmm, the prerequisite is no one's coming to you and giving this to you until you ask for it. You have to not just, yes, ask, you have to really want it. And then you get it. And this is in the Bible too. You know, if just ask,
yeah,
and you know, ask and you will be told, all the answers will be revealed to you, but you got to ask,
yeah,
first.
Yeah.
So essentially he talks about this crazy vision he had in Kathmandu, where he was shown Alpha Centauri, and he was told that humans are essentially larvae that is being grown in time space, in the medium of time space, where we're like, this is where our real mommy and daddy lay their eggs, and they grow us in time space, and then we get to, like, you know, join our true family. But you start,
right,
here. This,
right,
is where,
right,
you start.
This is the hatchery.
This is a hatchery. We are in a hatchery right now, and the hatchery idea, things get really interesting just if you play around with that thought experiment. You would expect, when an incubator is ready to hatch, an uptick in the midwives showing up, an uptick in... You would expect that,
right?
You know, when labor starts, that's when the doctor shows up. And so to me, that's the part that gives me a little bit of the wobbly creeps, is I think, like, wait, oh shit, are we about to hatch? Is that what's happening here?
I mean, dude, it kind of feels like we're about to hatch in different ways. I mean, the UFO, yeah, subject is one aspect of this, but like we were saying, you know, quantum mechanics, AI, psychedelic and consciousness studies, we're arriving at a new potential chapter in the human story. And I genuinely do get the sense that there is some level of preparation or subtle integration from this phenomena that's in some way either keeping tabs on us and keeping an eye on us as we get towards this state, or is in some way subtly assisting with us getting towards that state. And, you know, we were kind of talking about this before when just saying about how people look at the way the world is going, and it's a pretty cynical worldview because everything kind of is falling to shit, or at least it looks like it.
Yeah.
But you look at that from the perspective of your own life, and I've said this a few times, you know, at least for me, if I look at it from the perspective of my own life, dude, there's been so many moments where my personal world was falling apart, or so my personal reality was falling apart, and chaos and destruction in different ways. And it's like, you know, you're going through the fire. But when you have enough separation in time from that event and you look back, you go, oh, wow. Okay. I see how that clicked in place. I see how, as painful as it was necessary. It helped me grow. It helped me get stronger. It transformed me in some way. And if we look at the human species as a collective group, as a single entity, we're just going through the evolutionary stresses and strains and developmental hiccups along the road. And I do think, you know, especially when it really increases in intensity, I kind of get the feeling like with a human being, it's kind of like, you always have the ability to make that decision, to make that change that you need to make if you're not really being the full person you're supposed to be.
Yeah.
You do have the freedom to make that choice. We don't always make that choice. So reality comes along and just goes, oh, bam, and just like, I've made the choice for you. You either pick up these pieces and you build something better, or you just stay as a shattered thing. So most people would pick up the pieces over time and they build themselves together and they get over that event and they're stronger. And so I look at the way that the world is with, you know, kind of like geopolitical craziness and climate craziness and just social craziness. Everything's in hyper state. And I actually try and look at that as the best available evidence that we're transforming, that we're going through a process, that it's not always fun, it's not always easy, but it's necessary. It's a evolutionary prerequisite for us to get to the next stage. And anytime a old system or old model is replaced with a new one, by literal just cause and effect, that old one has to die off or blow to pieces, like disintegrate, because it's being replaced. Like the phoenix rising from the ashes, you have to go through that fire and then you get to rise out of it. And I think we're in that moment. I think we've had a lot of those moments throughout human history. We've demonstrated our transformative capabilities to adapt and grow. But this, where we are now, this is beyond the wheel. It's beyond electricity. It's beyond even fire, because we're at a position now where we're giving birth to like an artificial god, and we're a part of it. We're the gestation process for this technology. In fact, I was listening to, I can't remember which Joe Rogan episode it was, but he was talking to someone where they said that we are the sex organs for the artificial world. And I was like, damn, yeah, for the machine world, right? And I was like, yeah, damn, I kind of feel that. Like, I think it's more important than that, but it's also like, yeah, that's an element. We're giving birth to this stuff. So if evolution isn't making a mistake, if nature isn't making a mistake, because we are, unless the Anunnaki are real, we emerged from nature and we emerged from this planet and our consciousness developed and became more sophisticated, almost as if Mother Nature is cashing all her chips in the human species. It's like, right, I'm going to concentrate intelligence in this one primate species. Let's see if we can create a vehicle through which I can explore my own landscape. And we are the conscious explorers of our own planet, which means that we are, in some ways, our planet embodied as individuals exploring itself. And we have this insatiable internal, almost unconscious drive. We're just drive to innovation, creation, technology, just more complex. We're flinging ourselves out into space. And I think it was Terence McKenna that said that the job of the human species is to transform itself from a camel into an F-16 mid-flight.
Yeah.
And I love that. I love that, because it's like, yeah, we're like this shambling creature that's getting more streamlined, more fast, more acceleration. And so
I don't think evolution or nature has made a critical error with humanity. I think we're an expression of nature and we are following our evolutionary path. But we're such a novel, multifaceted creature that our path through evolution, when you're down in the trenches as just an individual kind of observer of it, it's like, dude, this is crazy. Right. Like, we're just insane. We're destroying our planet. And it's true. But these might all be just components of that step-by-step progression until we're ready to go out there. Man, until we're ready to voyage out into the great unknown.
Jay Anderson, thank you so much for coming on the show. Please come back on. Everybody, follow.
Dude, you're coming on mine next week. You're
I cannot
coming on
wait.
Me next week, 100%.
We will continue the conversation. Part two is next week. Project Unity, YouTube, Project Unity, Twitter. Follow both of these feeds. I'm telling you, folks, this is where I have gotten so much good information. So, and as you can tell, truly a brilliant person. Jay, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Duncan, it's been a pleasure to be repeated soon.
Hare Krishna, thank you. That was Jay Anderson, everybody. Won't you follow him on Twitter? Check out his YouTube channel. He's awesome. And I want to thank our sponsors for supporting the DTFH. And thank you for listening. I'll be back next week with an interview with Sasha Crespi, a famous illusionist. Until then, may God go with you into the night or day or wormhole or whatever it is you're worming your way into. I love you. I'll see you soon.